I'm Brandon Blackmore. I'm a small-time game author and publisher. Here with Steve Long, who's a big-time game author and publisher. And you wrote... we're starting now, by the way. This is my segue into starting. Are we ready?
Good.
Okay, good. I'm just going to introduce you briefly for the people in the audience who may not be aware of you. Steve Long is currently best known as the lead role. What's your actual title?
Technically, my title would be line developer, but that really isn't entirely accurate anymore because of the way we've shifted business, but that's a good enough way.
But best known as the line developer and honcho of Hero Games, publishers of Champions and other Hero Games, Hero System-related game systems, Champions being the best known, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
And although before that, he was a professional freelance game author, worked for a number of game publishers, and has outlasted several of them.
It's more than a couple.
We're very lucky to have him here today. So, good morning.
Yes, good morning. For me, at least, the three of you are not morning today, so.
I have a bunch of questions.
Go right ahead.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just going to start off completely. Can you hear me? Should I lean in? Can you hear me? Okay?
I don't think they're turned on.
No. Good.
Oh, I think you're right.
Those are for when they have, you know, Peter Davison in here and need to be heard over the roar.
Do you read comic books?
I have read many comics in the past and collected them. I don't currently keep up with them because the expense to quality ratio dropped to the point where it wasn't worth it for me. In my estimation, reasonable minds may differ.
They are quite a bit more expensive now than they used to be. That's a fact.
Every time I would go into the comic shop and spend $2.95 or $3.95 on a comic, I'm like, I remember when I got these for a quarter. and they were better.
Champions being the bread and butter of Hero Games is a superhero game system for people who may not know that. So do you like superheroes? I mean...
Well, absolutely. I've been a fan of comics. They were the first fantastic literature I ever read. Starting as a kid, I got really interested in Spider-Man from seeing him on The Electric Company, if you remember that
TV
show.
I do remember.
Yes. And I'd watch it, and so I started picking up the comic. They had one specifically aimed at kids called Spidey Super Stories. I got that, and then I started getting anytime the comic had Spider-Man in it, I'd buy it. And that gradually exposed me to the wider Marvel Universe. And it wasn't any sort of, you know, regimented thing. I'd go in and I'd pick whichever comics were cool off the spinner rack equal to the amount of money I had to spend. And so I have my older comics are this hodgepodge, you know, two issues here, three issues here. I rarely have, you know, more than an issue or two in succession in any one storyline. But then I quit reading them for a while, and then I got back into them in high school as I was gaming. And just, I started reading comics again just before I learned about Champions. So it was a perfect dovetail. I got back into reading comics hardcore, and then Champions came along.
Now, you started gaming, as I remember that from what we were talking about yesterday. You, like a lot of people, started with D&D.
Yes, back in 81, I want to say, 80, 81.
Which is kind of like this, the D&D popularity arc. It was like during the second D&D popularity.
Yeah, because at that point I had started reading fantasy literature, deriving out of my interest in mythology, and I saw, you know, this was when D&D was getting coverage in papers and in magazines as a fad, and I thought, oh, that sounds really cool, and I found a place that had a copy of, you know, it was a box with, you know, a wizard and a fighter facing a dragon on top of a pile of treasure, and the book inside was was this size book and had a blue cover. It's the blue cover edition of early D&D. And started reading that. I was absolutely hooked. You know, I got friends and I played, you know, in junior high, and they all quit pretty quickly, and I just kept right on going.
So, something we talked about yesterday, again. I'm going to refer to things, because we were on panels yesterday, so which made me think of things to ask today. One of the things that came up yesterday is, so you started with D&D and then branched out and played other things. I started with D&D and branched out and played other things. And why do you suppose it is that people who start with D&D or start with Champions continue to play, if they continue to play at all, they continue to play other games. Whereas with Vampire, because we were talking about Vampire as being kind of the, a fun game, and I played it myself, ran a great game, and you've played that.
Yeah.
But people who get into it through Vampire don't spread out as often. Why do you suppose that is?
Well, a couple reasons. First of all, I think it, arguably statistically, the average person who starts playing D&D, or now Pathfinder, doesn't ever go on to many other games. You know, he just continues playing that game as long as he wants to, and then is done with it. That's why D&D / Pathfinder has always had the largest playing group. It's always easiest to find players to play it.
Hmm.
The subsection of people that go on and play other games is a fraction of that number. You know, the rest of the industry is built on feeding off of whatever scraps we can bite off of the, you know, the carcass of D&D. You know, and the difference being that I think the percentage of people who play D&D and then go on and play other games is higher than the percentage who start with Vampire and never go on to anything. And I think some of the reason for that is the people who are attracted to D&D, and this is a generalization and not necessarily a fair one, tend to be of the more geekish persuasion. We're interested in geek-type hobbies, and that suggests to us, oh, I could use this to do space, I could use this to do that. The thing that made Vampire so successful was that it appealed to this goth subculture that wouldn't have identified themselves as gamers. You know, and therefore, they didn't say, like, I'm not a gamer, I play this goth vampire thing. You know, and so it didn't occur to them, most of them, to look for other games. If they did anything else, they transitioned from the tabletop to LARPing, or started with the LARPing and never went anywhere else. I'm sure for a while there, LARPing was so popular that you could do that and never have thrown any dice in the tabletop game.
Mm. Yeah, Camarilla still has their big LARP con down in New Orleans every year. The programming lead at DriveThruRPG, he goes every year. So yeah, I think you're right. One of the pieces of advice that get handed out to conventional authors, people who write prose, you know, short stories and novels and things, is if you want to be a good author, you should read a lot and read a lot of different things. Do you think that's true of game authors as well?
I think I wouldn't necessarily say you have to read a lot of games, though it helps.
No, I'm at play.
But I think if you're going to be a game designer, you need to play a lot of games. You need to see how, and not just other RPGs, try board games, try card games, see what's out there that works and find ways to incorporate it. Because, you know, there are RPGs that incorporate board game-like mechanics or card game-like mechanics. And even things like MMOs, you know, there are influences everywhere. Fourth edition D&D, for example, clearly derives from wanting to emulate a World of Warcraft or MMO-type experience rather than a more traditional D&D-type experience. And that's not necessarily good or bad, it's just a decision that's made. You know, I think that as good a designer as you may be, and as good as you are at getting it to work right on paper, ultimately, there's always the question of how does the rubber hit the road? Things may not work in play that work on paper, and vice versa. You know, when I first saw third edition D&D, I'm like, this doesn't make any sense. And a lot of things didn't make any sense to me on first read, but when I started playing it, it all was like, oh, that's why they did that. You know, and so I think it helps to keep you sort of fresh and focused. If you just write games and don't play them, eventually, you know, a certain sameness is going to crop into your work, and you're going to, you know, going to sort of get a little stale.
Interesting. You mentioned MMOs. Champions Online.
Yes.
Now, I'm a lifetime subscriber, and I have great fun with it. So, how did Champions Online come to be? I mean, why Champions Online?
Okay, Cryptic at the time had been working on a Marvel MMO, and the negotiations for that fell through. And Jack Emmert, one of the head honchos at Cryptic, you know, they still wanted to do a superhero game. They were best known for City of Heroes, and they wanted to capitalize on that. And they had all these assets they had started working on for the Marvel game that they now couldn't use. So, like, we need another superhero thing to do. And furthermore, Jack said, I absolutely refuse to get involved in this licensing. This is nonsense. If I'm going to do something, I want to own it. I want to be able to do what I want with it and not have to go back to Marvel or Sony for approval time after time after time, because that just derails the whole process. And Jack's a Champions fan from way back when. I first met him years ago when we were both freelance game writers. And he thought, well, there's a nostalgic appeal there. It's an established fan base, an established IP. We don't have to start creating things from scratch, which takes a long time, particularly when you're doing it more or less by committee. And so he picked up the phone one day and called my business partner, Darren, and said, hey, you guys want to sell Champions? Darren's like, let me get back to you. And he called me, and the thing just snowballed from there. And they eventually made us an offer, and we dickered back and forth. And, you know, they were willing to throw enough money at us that we were willing to sell them the Champions IP.
So does that mean that, Hero Games no longer has
Yes,
Champions?
Yes, Hero Games no longer owns the Champions IP, but we retain in perpetuity the right to do licensed Champions products for free. We don't have to pay them a licensing fee. They just have to approve them. You know, we can't do something that is going to contradict the game or that they feel reflects negatively on the IP. But yeah, I don't own Millennium City anymore. I don't own Defender or any of the characters or events that are involved in the Champions universe. We still own the Hero System rules. They didn't buy the rules, I don't own the IP anymore. The Champions universe is all them.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Now, do you get a percentage from that? Or?
No, we don't get a percentage.
Or they bought
the
it outright.
The deal is if the game had become incredibly successful and they sold ancillary products, novels, comic books, a movie deal, what have you, we are entitled to a slice of that. But sadly, it hasn't gone that far. Mm-hmm. I don't think any, well, certainly not for a company my size, we don't have the clout to negotiate percentage of game revenue. It would be nice if we did. But it was nice just to get a huge chunk of change. It was, you know, very handy in many ways. So, you know, it was worth it to us. I don't regret it. It would be nice. I didn't sell one or two of my favorite characters that I kept back. My business partner, Darren, sold his favorite character, but with the proviso that any time they use him, it has to say, Dr. Silverback created by Darren Watts. But I wish I had not sold them Hudson City, because they've ended up not using it, and I could do things with it. But it was part of the package. I can make up another fictional city if I want to.
True enough. Now, do you think, have MMOs peaked, or do you think it's, because it seemed to me, mm-hmm. and you can
yeah.
disagree or agree or give me your input, it seemed to me that for a good long while, right around the 2000s or so, that MMO, massively multiplayer online games.
World of Warcraft, for example.
EverQuest
would have been one. Ultima Online was the first one, I think.
Yeah, World of Warcraft being like the big one now.
Yeah.
That they were filling and overtaking the niche that RPGs had held since the mid-80s, late 80s. Mm-hmm. Do you think that's true? And do you think they still are?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, the truth is that when RPGs started at just the right time for them to become successful, it was the 70s, and there was enough ability to communicate with other people around the country, and to, you know, fans were starting to hold conventions like Star Trek conventions. So there was a community building, and the game could come out, and people would play it, and it was a competitive form of entertainment. There were no computer games at first, and the ones that did come out were very simple and very basic and very expensive. And a lot of times you didn't own your own computer, yet you had to play them on, you know, the university's mainframe or what have you, and not everybody had the capability to do that. And there were, when D&D started, there were no VCRs, all these entertainment options didn't exist. So it came along at a point in time where it could easily become a phenomenon. But after that, the story, if you look at gaming, the entire story of gaming is declining participation, and thus, from my, you know, the perspective of the producers, declining revenue. You know, there was a time when, you know, D&D sold so well week after week that the New York Times Review of Books had to change its rules to keep the D&D manuals from filling the top three positions in the New York Times bestseller list. They changed the rules to make game products no longer be eligible and to put them on some other list, if any. You know, or to give a more concrete example, you remember Module S2, White Plume Mountain, if any of you ever played old school D&D? That was released in 80 or 81, I want to guess, and sold 248,000 copies, and that was regarded as average, really. And today, a module like that, I don't know Paizo's numbers, but, you know, in the mid point of the last decade, the aughts, I suppose we call them, you know, Wizards was doing, well, I think if they sold 30,000 copies of a module, it would be considered a runaway success. You know, that's how far things have fallen, and that's for the big guy on the block. You know, the rest of us just have fewer and fewer scraps, because there are more ways to entertain yourself now. There are VCRs and DVD players. There are game products have risen in quality, but also in price. Computer game products have vastly improved in quality, and the price has come down to the point where they are either about the same, or the computer games, particularly now if we have free to play, are cheaper. And MMOs are just one more brick on that pile of things you can do that aren't gaming. And furthermore, as I mentioned in the panel yesterday, for the average person who would want to play RPGs, what they would want to do in an RPG and what they would want to get out of an RPG, 90% of those people get 90% of what they want out of gaming from World of Warcraft. And they get it at home whenever they want by turning on a computer. You don't have to assemble a group. You don't have to have somebody GM, which requires, in theory, hours of preparation before you play. You don't have to learn a 300-page rule book to play. There is a learning curve, particularly if you want to be a really skilled player, but it's not nearly the same. They ease you into it in a way that RPGs just can't. And so, but it provides that experience in a way that takes people who in 1978 or 1980 would have gravitated to D&D or some other form of role-playing games, and they just now go straight to WoW and never get to role-playing games. Or if they do get to them, they get to them later, and it's like, this is okay, but I'm just as good with WoW. Part of the trick to what's being done with game design today is trying to find ways to emphasize what makes role-playing games different or better than the computer gaming experience. D&D 4th edition shows pretty well. You can't compete with WoW. You can't try to do WoW as a tabletop game. You need to find ways to do things that WoW can't do. And or just appeal to your old school people who are still around playing your game after 20 or 30 years.
And Champions players in particular, Hero System fans in particular, are fiercely loyal.
They are. We wish there were more of them, but they do tend to be. It's one of the reasons that I was willing to put up the money and with my business partners and buy the company.
This was 2001.
This was 2001. Yeah, late 2001, December 19th, 2001 to be precise. I was one of those hardcore fans, and my business partner Darren and Jason were also hardcore fans. We knew the interest was there and the community was there. We could see them talking, on the message boards, as simple as they were back then, about what they wanted and the fact that they were still playing. When I, told my colleagues at Decipher at the time, that I was leaving, I was buying Hero Games and leaving, as they said later, the question to them was not, had I gone crazy, but what type of insanity I was coming down with. They didn't question for a minute that it was an idiotic thing to do. And then 2 years or so later, they all came up to me and said, okay, we were absolutely wrong, because they saw that we were producing books and publishing them and making money. Because they weren't Hero players, they had no idea that this community existed. And as I said, that year was, when I left Decipher, the last thing I did was finish up the Lord of the Rings role-playing game that I wrote for them. And it won the Origins Award that next summer for Best New Game. And when I got up to give my acceptance speech, by that point everybody knew I was with Hero. I had my Hero shirt on. I said, my only regret is that Christian, my boss, didn't listen to me when I said we should do this game using the Hero system. And I got a big laugh, but I had, in fact, tried to talk them into using the Hero system to do it. So I said, you guys don't get it. There's a huge base here. And they didn't... Honestly, they never would have done it anyway, because Decipher wanted its own in-house rule system. But, there was a market there that they just didn't know was there, because they didn't play that game. And I'm sure there are big markets for games that I don't play. Like, I've never played, any of Palladium's role-playing games, like Rifts. And I know there's a huge market out there that, Kevin Symbieta has figured out, my market wants this, and I'm going to give them this, and I'm going to give it to them again and again and again. And they just play that game, and they don't mingle with other gamers, and they're happy as clams. But I don't know about the size of that. I couldn't appeal to that market because I'm not part of it.
So do you think having that core group, you think that as a game author, because you've done a lot more than just
sure.
with your system.
Yeah.
Maybe not super recently, but you or have you?
Well, I've done bits and pieces of other things recently, but yeah, most of my pre-Hero work was done for other systems. Once I took over the company, there was no point devoting writing efforts to working for other companies. I even had to back out of a couple of existing contracts, one with Steve Jackson Games primarily, because you know, if I'm going to be writing something in my spare time, why don't I just write another book for my company and make more money?
Fair enough.
You know, and in fact, I did that a couple times.
So having that very specific core group of that audience that you're aiming your stuff toward, and Champions at the time it came out. Which is very early, 81. What was extremely innovative for its time,
yes.
But fashions change,
yes.
Game mechanic wise, the way, you know, it's just the nature of things,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
Do you think that having that core group of people who you know are your core audience, does that limit you as a designer, or do you think that that's...
No, I don't think it does. I think, you know, the truth is there are lots of games out there competing for share. And as I mentioned in the talk yesterday, the truth is that there's no one gaming market. There are 1,000 gaming markets because any 5 role-playing game groups are going to give you at least 4 and possibly 6 different ways to play role-playing games. They have very different opinions about what they want to do and very different ways of doing it. So the trick is to come up with a product that appeals to enough of those 1,000 niches for you to make money. You know, I am deliberately creating a product that appeals to people who want a lot of the ability to have a lot of detail if they want it, and a lot of creative freedom. Most games don't give them that. If there were other games out there giving them that, I wouldn't be able to keep publishing because somebody else would have come along and taken that market share away during the half decade in the 90s when Hero was essentially moribund. You know, and no one does that. To this day, I would argue there is no game that really does what the Hero system does. No one's ever tried to do it, partly because they know Hero does it and they know what Hero's market is and don't need anybody else to do it. Mutants and Masterminds, for example, comes close with superheroes, but it only comes close and it's a different kind of way of doing it.
Yeah, it really, my own personal experience, most of my friends who still play, they're Hero fans through and through.
Sure.
We all started playing, you know, Champions and Fantasy Hero and Star Hero back in the very early, mid-80s,
yeah.
Most of us. And it's still the go-to game for pretty much everybody who's, I consider, an old friend of mine.
Yeah.
And Mutants and Masterminds, we've all played it.
Sure.
It appeals to, it scratches a slightly different itch.
Yeah.
You know?
Hey, I've tried playing it, and it's a fine game. It's just, it's not what I want to do. I want the fuller freedom that Hero gives me. And that's... is purely a personal thing. I know many people who would say the exact opposite.
Well, that's why they make more than flavor ice cream.
Exactly.
So, that's really interesting.
Yeah, we all, you know, I don't know if it's true today. I don't have the market statistics to prove it, but historically, because there were relatively few superhero games, it was generally true that a rising tide lifted all boats. Anytime a new superhero game was published, it meant more superhero resources for anybody who wanted to do that kind of gaming, and therefore everybody who was still around would benefit. You know, Steve Peterson, the former owner, the guy who's in charge of the business side primarily of the company, told me once that he used to see in his marketing, whenever somebody else would issue a big new superhero game, he would see an uptick in sales of Champions. Because people were getting interested in superheroes again, and that meant they, some of them at least, were going to, oh, I remember Champions. This is the flagship superhero game. You know, because in the 80s and through the 90s, there really was no competition. You know, people, you know, Pinnacle tried Brave New World, and White Wolf tried Aberrant, and there were other attempts. You know, there was the Mayfair DC Heroes game, there was the Marvel Superheroes game. All those games came and went, sometimes in multiple iterations, and Champions just kept right on. You know, it's been published, you know, pretty much steadily for 32 years now.
Well, it's impressive by any measure. So, circling around to other superhero games and licensing.
Mm-hmm.
This is something I personally I've wondered about.
Yeah.
Because pretty much every superhero, there are probably exceptions, but there's licensed comic book adaptations, game adaptations from comic books using icons. Mutants and Green Ronin, who publishes Mutants and Masterminds, they're currently doing a DC game.
Yes.
You had TSR, who used to publish D&D. They did the Marvel game.
Yeah, and now Mayfair, Weiss is doing the Marvel game.
Yeah, Weiss is doing the Marvel game now. And Margaret Weiss did Supernatural game and the Smallville game.
Yeah, and the Leverage game, and they just got the license to do Firefly.
Yeah. So
just announced that the other day.
And I could
in addition to the Serenity game, which they already had.
Yeah.
So now they've got the full Firefly Magilla.
Yeah. So all these other superhero game systems have tried licensing or have licensed for a period of time other people's settings.
Yes.
Champions has never done that, as far as I know.
With the exception of the PS2 38 game we did a few years ago with our friend Aaron Williams, the cartoonist.
I did not know.
Yeah, we did. It's a like our other licensed games, like the MHI RPG. I just finished writing it. It's a self-contained thing. We have the rules and the setting material all in one. And for those of you who are not familiar with PS2 38, I highly recommend it. It's Aaron's comic strip about a school for elementary kids with superpowers, the children of superheroes and things like that. And it's written with wonderful wit, and it's touching, and it's just amazing. And it's been going on for quite some time now. And he wanted to do a game, and we wanted to do it, and it sold very well for us for a couple of years there. It's a great game, particularly to play with your kids, because they can play kids who have superpowers. You know, so they have a lot of fun with it. But yeah, other than that, Hero has never really pursued superhero licensing in particular, because it's hellaciously expensive and difficult to deal with. You know, I can't speak entirely for the former owners. I don't know if they ever pursued anything, but certainly if they did, nothing ever came of it. And I don't remember them ever telling me about anything like that, because dealing with Marvel or DC requires a lot of money and a lot of patience going through approvals. And it's more than one game company who's had a licensed product has crashed on the rocks of, we've got a product, we need to get it out and publish it and make money, but it's held up in approval for 3 months. Because, you know, I've done two different iterations of Star Trek role-playing. I've done Lord of the Rings. I've done The Wheel of Time. You know, I've done a lot of licensed games. And they're fun to do, and there are some real strengths to them. But there are some downsides, and one of those downsides is approval. If you're the guy in the Marvel licensing department, your job is to issue approvals. On your desk today, you have two things. You have a coffee mug with Spider-Man's face on it. You have a 300-page rule book for which you have to approve every paragraph and every piece of art. This is going to make 5 times as much money as that. Where do you emphasize your time? You emphasize your time approving coffee mugs. Unless you just happen to like what the role-playing game company is doing, and we fortunately had that at Paramount when we were doing the Star Trek games. Our licensed people loved what we were doing, and in the entire 2-plus years that we did the last Unicorn Star Trek game, they only ever disapproved 3 or 4 things. Other than that, they were very willing, 3 or 4 specific things, they were very willing to let us do what we wanted to do and play around with their IP. But Marvel, at least, is not like that. I can't speak for DC. They're going to be very cautious about what they do, and they're going to want you to hew to their vision. Of, like, for example, when Margaret Weiss does their Marvel game, I'm pretty sure that it looks at the way the Marvel Universe is today. If I'm going to do a Marvel game, I'm going to do Marvel the way the Marvel Universe was from about 1975 to about 1990. You know, back when it was good, back when it wasn't so complicated. You know, and they're not going to let you do that. Just like if I were going to try to license Star Trek today, CBS would absolutely refuse to let me do stuff in DS9 or Voyager or TNG, because they want it all to reflect the Abrams verse. You know, they before the first Abrams movie came out, they deliberately did not renew or pulled back in, I think, all of their licenses for old material, because they didn't want it out there anymore. They didn't want it competing with the new vision for Star Trek. You know, I don't want to deal with the money, which is going to be absurd, and I don't want to deal with the headaches. If Marvel came to us and said, we'd like you to do a game, and we'll give you some money to make it look really good, and we'll give you free access to our art library, and there's only one person you'll ever have to deal with in the company, then I'd consider it. But they're going to come to me with that deal the day that Pig Sprout wings. You know, it's the way it is. You know, on the other hand, you know, by developing the Champions Universe IP over 20, 30 some years, we were eventually able to sell that to Cryptic for a very nice piece of change. You know, at that time, I don't think there was a single other MMO that was based on a property taken from role-playing games and put into another medium. They were all based on original material. There will, in theory, eventually now be a World of Darkness MMO from CCP. But generally speaking, Champions Online is unique right now in that respect, and it's because we chose to focus on our own IP. You know, I think, as despite the fact that I am now doing licensed games and I enjoy doing licensed games, I would much prefer if the gaming industry could survive on its own, creating its own IP. Because, you know, as cool as I think the Dresden Files role-playing game from Evil Hat is, I would much rather see Fred Hicks's take on an original urban fantasy setting than his stats for Harry Dresden. You know, I think ultimately, as profitable as they often are, and there's a reason people keep doing them, they make a lot of money, licensed games are to a certain extent self-defeating. You're cannibalizing on somebody else's property and ending up with nothing to show for it yourself, and your own creativity is being sublimated. But the blunt fact is that what I create on my own does not sell nearly as well as, you know, hero stats for Spider-Man. Mm. You know, so that's why you do it. And, you know, we, for example, I'm having a blast. I'm now doing, just finished the Monster Hunter International role-playing game for, based on Larry Correa's best-selling novels from Bane Books. And it's a hell of a lot of fun. You know, the writing a licensed game is its own, is a fascinating challenge, trying to adapt something that was never intended to be a game. You know, where the, particularly, for example, in writing The Lord of the Rings, I'm like, I had to comb through the novels and to, you know, offhanded references to things that Tolkien just threw out, never thinking, of, okay, that implies this about the world, therefore I have to have this. You know, and when I first got back to Larry Correa with my outline and initial runs of questions about, okay, you say this, does that imply this about his world? He's like, you could sort of see him scratching his head. I didn't quite think this through, did I? Let me get back to you. You know, and one of the values for to him of us doing this game is he now has in one place all the information he needs about his own world going forward. You know, he can consult the RPG for information rather than having to comb back through his own novels and figure out, did I say this or did I say that? You know, so it can be a lot of fun, but ultimately I think there's a huge amount of creativity in role-playing games, and I wish our audience was big enough that we could capitalize on that and have, you know, at the risk of sounding like I'm trying to set myself up or something, have, you know, best-selling properties and authors who are regarded as well as best-selling fiction authors are, and, you know, make a, have a, the community be what it would be, you know, could have been in the early 80s if we'd had the internet. Mm. You know. But of course, if we'd had the internet, it would have all been different now.
So, from... Do you think that the reason why the game authors and game settings generally, you know, I guess World of Darkness is kind of an exception, mm-hmm. but generally don't get the same kind of exposure and branching out and you know, T-shirts and coffee mugs and so forth that, say, a comic book or a movie does? And, and actually, comic books nowadays seem to be more or less just pitches for movies.
Yeah, I think Marvel gave up on, they don't really want to publish comic books anymore so much as they want to be in the movie business, and I don't blame them because they figured out how to do it right and are making piles of money.
Yeah.
But
so
if,
comic
if you
books
go back,
like,
for example,
bed for new
if,
characters
if you, I just
movies.
Got done reading Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, which is a history of Marvel Comics, and quite an interesting read, and, you know, Stan Lee, you know, of course, as many of you know, he hasn't really been involved in creating Marvel Comics since the early 70s. He's been out in Hollywood that whole time trying to get Marvel movie deals going. They haven't really wanted to be in the comic book business to a certain extent for decades. It's just they've only now figured out how to do it right. Technology has caught up with them. You know, and nowadays, what you see is, you know, it used to be you'd get one creative team on a comic book, and it would stay on that book for a year, 2 years, or in the case of, for the big companies, at least, the record holder, Chris Claremont, being on Uncanny X-Men for 185 issues, you know, without a break. And that gave you a creative continuity, and it let you tell stories, and it you didn't have to wreak radical changes in characters' lives to attract readers' attention. But now it's all done in 6 to 10 issue chunks that can be packaged in trade paperback format, because the trade paperbacks are very profitable. You know, and so you bring in a team, this team has a story they want to tell, they tell that story and it does something to the character, often something big and impressive, then they leave and another team comes on and they do their big impressive thing and they leave and another team comes on. So you don't get that continuity of storytelling that you used to get. You get
events.
This events, you get this very episodic rather than serial thing in a medium that is, by its very definition, the ultimate, you know, other than soap opera, the ultimate sort of serial thing, the monthly publication. You know, and so, yeah, it's much more attuned to the movies now, absolutely. And, again, I don't blame them, because Marvel, at least, seems to have figured out the formula, how to make a good superhero movie. The last two or three, the worst of them was Thor, and that was not bad. It just doesn't hold a candle to Captain America or Iron Man or Spider-Man or the Avengers. You know, when that's your comparison, is I'm not quite as good as those, you know, you're doing pretty well. So, and DC is sitting there just, you know, gnashing their teeth. How how can we do this? And they're desperately trying to figure out a way to do it and hoping to launch a Justice League movie, I think, or have one in production for 2015. But unlike Marvel, Marvel spent, what, 5 years building up to the Avengers with individual movie releases? It was almost like a comic book. You know, we had all these individual comic books, and then we combined them into the Avengers, and it worked because we weren't introducing all these characters right away. They already had a backstory. It worked perfectly. It was just like 1963 all over again.
Yeah. It's crazy that Hulk, I would not say Thor was the worst of them.
I'm talking about the recent run. Hulk is a little earlier. But I agree. I don't think the Hulk movies have lived up to what they could be.
Yeah. Well, Hulk's a very difficult character to build a movie around because he's not a good guy.
Yeah.
He's Mr. Hyde.
Yeah.
But
you have to write him very carefully to make him a good guy. There are some wonderful Hulk stories from the late 70s, early 80s period, but Hollywood just doesn't have the sophistication to do that.
Yeah, it takes a subtle hand.
Yeah.
But in the Avengers, in that context, I think Hulk was fantastic.
He was
probably the best appearance of Hulk in a medium other than comic books that I personally have ever seen.
I agree. No, I absolutely agree with you, and I'm glad that Mark Ruffalo, apparently he had signed a 6-movie deal to do the Hulk in a total of 6 movies. So that's one of them. Yeah, so there are some more Hulk movies and, of course, Avengers movies coming. But yeah, and I think the difference there is Joss Whedon. Joss Whedon knows how to write superheroes, and more importantly, he knows and loves the Marvel Universe. You know, for the same reason, what made the Iron Man movie so great is Jon Favreau loves Iron Man. He wasn't doing it as a job, he was doing it as a labor of love. You know, and I think the same applies to Joss Whedon, and the same applies to, for example, Brian Michael Bendis writing New Avengers. You know, the first 15 or 20 issues he did of New Avengers just ooze with, God, I love these characters, I can't believe I get to write them. You know, you can just see it coming through. And that leads to a better product. Something you do for love always tends out better than something you're doing for a paycheck.
The DC superhero movies, to varying degrees, always kind of strike me as like we're all just at work.
Yeah.
You know, Ryan Reynolds as Green Lantern. I never believe he's actually Green Lantern. To me, it's like
Green Lantern wasn't horrible, but it didn't wow me the way a superhero movie should. Yeah. You know, and I've never been a big Superman fan, so I really can't comment on those movies. I'm a huge Batman fan, and I would argue they have never done a good Batman movie. I still don't think they've done one. I don't like any of the ones they've done to varying degrees. But I know I'm in the minority on that. Many people like Dark Knight, for example. Many people love the original Batman movie that Tim Burton did. I'm just, you know, picky, and as Laura knows, I just don't like anything.
Well, it's odd, I think, considering how iconic DC superheroes are. Everybody knows who Superman is.
Yeah.
Everybody knows who, people who've never even picked up a comic book, knows who Batman is.
Yeah.
Everybody pretty much knows who Green Lantern and Wonder Woman are. They know who they are, even if they don't know what
they know Wonder Woman. I don't think they know Green Lantern. That was part of the problem with that movie. But they would know Wonder Woman if there's a reason that you can't get a good Wonder Woman movie going, even with Joss Whedon writing it. And that's that once you get past her origin, Wonder Woman has nothing to sell her. She's not interested, unless you want to do Frank Cho pinup artwork. You know, she has no good iconic villains. She has no good iconic stories. Tell me a classic Wonder Woman story, aside from her origin. Tell me one. There isn't one. You know, and that's why if you're going to get a movie out of that, it's got to be an origin story, and then they've got to get somebody creating new material, and they just can't seem to get that working.
The best Wonder Woman stories seem to always tie back to
Wonder Woman relate to Batman? How does Wonder Woman relate to Superman? The way in the Justice League Unlimited cartoon, the way they cast a relationship or a potential relationship between Wonder Woman and Batman was better than anything that had been done in a Wonder Woman comic for 20 years.
That's
true. It
was
wonderful.
That's true. It had never occurred. Dialogue.
Yeah. Attitude-wise, you know, powers-wise, Wonder Woman and Superman make a couple like they do at the end of Kingdom Come. Attitude-wise, Wonder Woman and Batman, that's something to think about. Holy crow, it had never occurred to me. And the guys who were doing that cartoon, they knew what they were doing. They were doing it well. And that was just like, wow, somebody found something interesting to do with Wonder Woman. But it's in relation to another character.
This is interesting. The DC Universe cartoons have universally been better than the DC Universe movies.
Yes.
So you think that's a reflection of how many fingers are in the pie? Because you have a much smaller group, and the approval process, too.
I don't know what goes on behind the scenes. My guess is that is specifically they've got a wonderful team creating those cartoons. I think when they started with Batman the Animated Series, which is just wonderful, they stumbled onto a formula, the Bruce Timm style artwork and that style writing. And I haven't checked the credits, but I assume that the Justice League cartoon and the Teen Titans cartoon involve a lot of those same people.
Well, Andrea Romano, who did the casting for virtually all of those, she clearly knows what she's doing.
I think they've latched onto a great group of people and they're creating something. You know, just like Marvel lucked into a great group of creators in the early 60s and created something that we're now seeing in the cineplexes. You know, and they just haven't gotten that same team or synergy with the movies. And producing an animated TV show is a much simpler, less complicated, and easier to handle process than producing a movie. You know, you don't have 10 minutes of credits at the end of every animated cartoon episode. You know, and you know, at the end of that list of people just goes like, holy mother, how do they get these things done? I'm amazed any of these movies ever get finished.
Well,
it's like creating cats.
In this room yesterday, Orson Scott Card was talking about the Ender's Game movie and the process of making movies based on things, and he had some unflattering things to say about the Hollywood hierarchy.
Yes, I think I've heard a couple of those things.
The bureaucracy involved.
Yes.
And my impression is that there's a much, much smaller bureaucracy involved with making animation than there is with making a movie.
I am absolutely sure.
Because the amounts of money being thrown around is much smaller.
Exactly. You know, and I mean, I would be interested to know that the comparing or the other statistic I want to see is how do the creative team and approvals and bureaucracy compare on Arrow or on Smallville versus a movie? And again, I think they're smaller and easier to deal with. DC seems to have figured out how to do pretty good superhero TV shows, which Marvel, barring the S.H.I.E.L.D. show, if that ever gets to our screens, you know, hasn't ever tried to do. And I suspect part of that is licensing. You know, for the same reason we don't see Spider-Man showing up in the Avengers movie because of licensing issues, or the X-Men, they may not have the licenses to do those things right now, or they may not want to do them for whatever reason. But DC has found a good way to mine their IP. I mean, Smallville, for at least a few seasons, was a pretty darn good show. I didn't stick with it beyond about season 5, but the fact that it lasted for 10 seasons says something. They were appealing to somebody. You know, and Arrow so far, I've rather liked. I mean, let's face it, it's their, you know, it's an ersatz Batman story. It's Green Arrow is Batman because we can't do a Batman TV show. You know, but I'm enjoying it. I have yet to see an episode that I didn't like on some level. And they're doing a great job integrating what backstory and past Green Arrow has into this slightly altered TV universe, in my opinion. So, you know, as long as it's good, I'll keep watching.
Yeah, we watch it.
Yeah,
I think Susan mainly watches it for his abs.
Well,
because he's
got
some awesome,
ripped. Yeah.
They remind her of my abs. Is why she likes them so much. But yeah, we watch it. I find he's really wooden, but physically, I mean, you know that there was a lineup of guys who auditioned, and he wasn't the best actor in the group. But God, that man is
physically
fit.
I am willing to forgive the woodenness on the grounds that he's been out of human contact for 5 years, and if it doesn't change, it's going to grate on me. But if they leave it for a season and then he warms up, but I think you're right. I think it's his acting talent, not something they're consciously doing. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't bug me yet. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like the sister.
The sister is a great supporting character.
She's a good balance to his his post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Affectation, if it is one. Actually, all right, let's go back to gaming.
Okay.
We've talked about movies and stuff. I'd probably do that all day, but game stuff. You worked on a bazillion things. Well over 100, right?
Yeah, I've written, I haven't counted fully, but by this point I think I've written, co-written, or edited about 200 role-playing game books, games, and game supplements.
Yeah, that's...
Something a little south of 200, if not at 200.
Yeah, you're among a very small group of people.
Yeah.
Who actually has made a living doing that,
yes.
I would think.
Yeah, at one point, I was making a full-time living as a freelancer, and I think I arguably was then, and maybe still am, the only person to make a living freelancing in gaming who had no outside supporting income. I had no wife. I'm not married. I don't have any other form of money coming in. I made my living solely from writing role-playing games. And while there are other people whose productivity is as high as mine, they all had additional... They had wives. They, you know, tricked women into marrying them and took advantage of it. I've just never been able to pull that off.
Yeah.
But yeah, I for a long time I was a freelancer, and it's a lot of fun, but the trick to it is you spend at least a third of your time drumming up more work. You know, it's a different process.
Yeah. Having worked in IT contracting myself, it's Yeah, pretty much a third of my time was spent finding something to do after my current thing ended. So how do you, what's your process like to work that much on so many different things? I mean, it seems like you'd have to be immensely disciplined.
Well, yeah, you do. If you're anybody who's going to work for himself at home has to have a certain level of discipline, or
it's like, what's your process
a magic
like?
Secret. Well, as I was talking about earlier, when people were complaining about, you know, 10 a.m. seminars, I'm a morning person. I tend to get up early, 5:30 or 6, and have a little breakfast and get to work, and I work until lunch, and that's the bulk of my working day. You know, anybody who's done creative work can tell you, you just like you reach a point where your muscles can no longer lift as effectively, you're tired, you reach a point where the quality of your creativity begins to drop off, and your attention span begins to drop off. So when I come back from lunch, I get less done in the afternoon, even the same amount of hours, because my brain is starting to run out of steam, and I'm starting to get more easily distracted by Facebook or a pretty bird outside the window, or look, it's a cat, you know, or I think I'm going to take a little break. You know, it's just, I get my best work done in the morning. But that, you know, when I first started freelancing, I was very concerned about that. I was thinking, you know, how am I going to make sure I stay productive? And what I actually did was, you know, I quit being a trial attorney to, you know, become a full-time freelance game designer. And for a couple of weeks, every morning I'd get up and I'd put on my dress shirt and my tie and my dress pants and my dress shoes as a way of telling myself, you are working, you are here to work. And after 2 or 3 weeks, I realized, I'm good, I don't need to do this. And I just stopped doing it. But that was one of the ways I signaled to myself, you are at work, you are not goofing around at home.
Yeah, I do that same thing.
Yeah, and then, you know, I work in the afternoon until I'm, you know, burned out, as long as I don't have a really tight deadline. And one of the great things about working for myself running Hero is, even if in theory I have a deadline, the truth is it's done when I'm done with it, and, you know, there's not much that can be said otherwise. I mean, that's one of the reasons I bought the company, but...
Now, do you focus on one project at a time, or do you alternate?
No, typically I focus on one thing at a time. I've got this, I start at the beginning, I keep going. One of the ways, though, that I trick myself into continuing to be productive in the afternoons is I'm like, okay, I'm working on this chapter 2, I don't like this nearly as much. The stuff in chapter 4 is going to be way more fun to write. Let's do that this afternoon. And so I'll jump around a little bit that way. But if I want to continue working in the evenings after dinner, I won't work on anything I'm currently being paid to do. I'll work on something for fun, or a spec project, or a little PDF I can publish myself, and that's another way of being productive without having to continue focusing on the same thing.
Hmm. What's your favorite game, or source book, or whatever, that you have not worked on, that you have no connection to?
That's a good question. I often do a panel at GameCon, at cons like this, called Gaming Supplements Every Gamer Should Own, meaning not games, but game supplements that are just so good you should own a copy of them. And it's hard to pick just one, but if I had to pick one that I would say is
we'll
my
pick
favorite,
a couple, whatever.
I would say first off I'd have to pick Delta Green for Call of Cthulhu. That's one of most game designers, or I at least, when I look at a game supplement, I'm like, this is pretty cool, but I could have done it better. I look at Delta Green and I'm like, holy crap, there's no way I could do this better. This is genius. You know, I couldn't have done this. If I had done this, it would be worse. That's one that I really like. An old supplement for Castle Falkenstein, one of the early, I suppose, steampunk games, called Comme-il-faut, is a favorite of mine. And it is a guide to how to behave properly in a Victorian world, written as a sort of a advice manual to travelers. And it's chock full of real-world data that's fed to you in such a way that you're just having all kinds of fun reading it. You know, it's like, if you fold this corner of your business card down when you send it in, it means you want to do this. And just all this information they dredged out of late 19th century manuals of manners and etiquette guides. And it's just, it's fascinating reading, you know, done with the gloss of, we have steampunk tech and magic in this setting. It's just wonderful. If I had ever gotten to do a steampunk hero, you know, the first thing I would have done for supplements was I would have called Mike Pondsmith and say, hey, Mike, would you license me to republish Comme-il-faut with Herostats? Because it's just perfect. I can't do that anymore.
So, if, because the realities of business is you don't want to spend, you know, 6 months working on a project that's not going to...
Oh, I can't. You know, during the 10 years I was, you know, primary hero line developer with our production model at the time, in 10 years we did 110 books. We had to have a book every month or two coming out to keep the money coming in. you can't spend. The reason I never got to do The Ultimate Weapon or The Ultimate Armor or many other books I wanted to do is it would have taken me 6 months of research to do them, and we can't afford to spend 6 months for me to write a book and 2 more months to produce it. We can't do it.
Under your aegis,
yes.
Hero Games had, I think, the most consistently high level and consistently frequently published. I mean, it was really astonishing, especially considering how you use the word moribund, outstanding work.
Yeah.
Like during the Iron Crowns era, yes. Iron Crown
during
era.
The early Iron Crown era, 91 or 2 to 95, it produced a good, it was typically, he was producing 6 to 8 books a year. It was doing more than we remember. But the 96 to 2001 period, virtually nothing was published. They tried the Champions New Millennium setting where they tried to change it to be more imagey and were adapting their new fusion rules, and that just laid a big fat egg. Nobody wanted it. And there was no money coming in. They found other things to do, and the game just sort of lay there for a while, even though they had my manuscript for the 5th edition in hand. It sat around for 3 or 4 years, and that was one of the reasons that the company was a good acquisition, was we knew we had a new product everybody wanted.
Now, if somebody was just going to throw a pile of money at you and say, do whatever you want, write a book that you want to work on, and we're paying for it. You don't have to worry about if there's an audience. You don't have to worry about if anybody will buy it at all. What would that be?
Would this be a licensed game or just anything?
Anything. What would your dream thing, if money were not an issue, and you could just spend your time
writing
a book?
The main dream thing right now is a book that I'm working on in my spare time called Mythic Hero. I tried to Kickstarter it this time last year, and it sadly fell a few $1,000s short, and I may try it again. But those of you who are old school D&D players may remember Deities and Demigods, the D&D manual to mythologies around the world. Mythic Hero is my version of D&Ds and Demigods cranked up to about 13. It's many, many more mythologies with much, much greater level of detail, because the first fantastic literature I ever read was mythology. From mythology, I got into fantasy and science fiction, and from that, I got into gaming. So I can sort of trace my whole career back to one copy of Dallaire's Norse Gods and Myths on the shelf in my elementary school. But I came up with the idea to do this book 2 or 3 years ago. I'm like, holy crap, why didn't I think of this before? And we put it on our production schedule, and I realized 3 weeks in, I had a list of 15 mythologies to cover, and I'd spent 3 weeks, and I wasn't even finished with the first one. I'm like, guys, we need to take this book off the schedule. I'm not going to be able to do this in time. So I've just been plunking away at it, continuing in my spare time, just having fun. It's so much fun to me that I just keep doing it, and if I can finish it and figure out a way to do it, I'll publish it. But if somebody threw a big pile of money at me, that's what I'd use it for. Right. If it were to get a license, part of the problem is all the things I would want to do with licenses are kind of already taken. I'd love to do a Marvel game, my version of Marvel, but sadly nobody's throwing
like
that kind of money.
Marvel.
It would be more a Bronze Age Marvel, I would suppose you would say, 75 to 85 kind of thing.
All right, running out of time. What's the next big thing coming out from
The next big thing coming out from Hero is the Monster Hunter International Employees Handbook and Role-Playing Game, which is a licensed game based on Larry Correia's best-selling Monster Hunter International novels, which are slam-bang, fun action. We are loaded down with guns and going out and shooting vampires and werewolves and saving the world from being eaten by Cthulhu. They're all kinds of fun. If you haven't read them, I thoroughly recommend them. You'll fly through them. They're great page-turners. And we're fans of Larry's work, and we thought, what the hell? Let's ask him. Hey, Larry, would you be interested in doing a licensed role-playing game? And he happens to be a gamer himself. And he said, I'd never thought about it, but yeah, I kind of would. And it just all sort of went from there. And I already happened to know Laura at Bain, and so that sort of smoothed the process. And I've been doing, I finished that a couple weeks ago, and it's just been all kinds of fun. We did a Kickstarter. We raised $80,000 to produce the book.
Almost doubled.
Yeah, we wanted $45,000 to do it. We ended up getting $80,000. And for 10 hours, we were the 10th highest earning role-playing game Kickstarter of all time. And then Robin came along with his Hill Folk Kickstarter and kicked us out. But, for a brief shining moment. So that was a lot of fun. And we're hoping, I think it's going to be a great seller for us, not only through the Kickstarter, of course, but I think it's going to continue to be a strong seller for us going forward in the future. And maybe we'll do a few supplementary products or... We'll probably end up looking into eventually doing Larry's Grimnoir Chronicles as an RPG and maybe looking at some other stuff, because I think we've got a good formula for doing this. It's a question of finding an author we can work with and a property that makes a good game and a strong online community. And not all of that works together all the time. But it's, in the case of the Monster International books, it's been like an absolute perfect storm. It's just everything.
When do you think that'll be out?
It's scheduled to be shipped in May, and we're still on track for that. You know, we can't always control what printers and shippers are going to do, but the book's about to, is pretty much in layout. I held our layout guy off because I got Larry's notes and a couple of other test readers' notes. I'm like, stop flowing layout. I can send you a corrected manuscript and save us all 2 days of work down the line, because it's much easier to correct it now than for me to have to go back through the manuscript and correct it then. So we're looking at having that out again in probably about mid-May, I think, so it'll be out in plenty of time for the summer convention season, and I think be a good seller for us going forward.
Oh, cool. I hope it is.
Thank you.
All right. Steve Long, ladies and gentlemen.
I'll be around all weekend. If you have any questions, just let me know. Thanks.